Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Emily Dreifuss. This is On Point. The president promised yesterday he'd decide very soon how to respond to the Syrian regime, which once again allegedly dropped chemical weapons on its own civilians, killing dozens, including children. But distracting from that crisis comes something new for him to be outraged about, the FBI raid on his lawyer's offices. And so we begin there, this hour On Point, the FBI raid, and later in the hour, the White House's Syria challenge. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of the FBI raid on Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's offices and residences? An attack on our country, as the president said last night, or the rule of law in action? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington to talk about the FBI raid is Kimberly Atkins, Washington bureau chief for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, thanks for joining me.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well.
So, Kim, can you walk us through what's going on with Michael Cohen? Who did the FBI, where did the FBI raid, where did the order come from, and what does it mean?
Yeah, so there were raids yesterday at Michael Cohen's office and at his home, a hotel where he had been staying, involving about 12 FBI agents, and they sought things including bank records, some communications that he had, including potentially communications with the president, who is his client, and information that is related to the Stormy Daniels lawsuit, which, of course, Michael Cohen has been most prominent recently as representing Donald Trump and having admitted to paying Stormy Daniels $130,000, which he claims was totally of his own money and had nothing to do with the president as part of a non-disclosure agreement. Now, this raid was spurred by the Mueller investigation in that as Robert Mueller and his team continue their investigation into potential Trump campaign connection to mm-hmm. Russian meddling, they have the ability, if they come across information that could be involved in another crime, to refer that matter to the appropriate authorities. In this case, they referred this matter to the Manhattan prosecutors, the Manhattan investigators who in turn authorized this raid. They went and got a warrant for this search, and that is what happened yesterday.
Now, how common is it for a warrant to be issued to a lawyer to allow access to privileged client communications?
Yeah, it's not usual, but it's obviously possible, as we see it happen here. Yes, these communications, obviously, between a lawyer and his client can be privileged, but there is something called the crime fraud exception, which means that the privilege goes away if the communication between an attorney and a client are used to further a crime, or are communicating about a crime, planning of a crime, some sort of fraud. Then there is no more privilege, and so that is the question here. What of this information that was taken is potentially about this? So, and it's also worth noting that getting a warrant to execute this type of search, there's a really high standard that goes there. A judge
right.
has to approve it. They have to look at the evidence that is presented by the prosecutors in order to get this kind of warrant. And given the high-profile nature of Michael Cohen, obviously the judge would be aware of how a search like that would look. And so if there was really no there, I find it very difficult to believe that this warrant could have been executed. So I think that it is certainly, something that should have Michael Cohen and potentially Donald Trump concerned.
Right. The fact that they were able to get the warrant really seems to indicate that they have some sort of evidence that there's something going on. Now, that is not what Donald Trump seems to suggest. Last night, he was seated with his cabinet and his generals to plan a response to the Syria chemical attacks, but he went on a long tirade against American law enforcement for this raid. Let's take a listen to his reaction.
It's a disgrace. It's frankly a real disgrace. It's an attack on our country in a true sense. It's an attack on what we all stand for. So when I saw this and when I heard it like you did. I said, that is really now in a whole new level of unfairness.
So it's interesting because, then he tweeted this morning, actually, attorney-client privilege is dead. But as you noted, there are these known exemptions to attorney-client privilege. Now, I wonder if you could mention what are some of the things that the FBI may be looking for in those records. The Washington Post reported that Cohen may be suspected of bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations. Kim, is it possible that all three of those suspected charges have to do with the Stormy Daniels payoff, or is there something else going on?
I think both of those things could be true. I mean, we have been hearing that the payoff to Stormy Daniels could have been considered a campaign donation in kind, which is prohibited. It's hard to believe that campaign finance contribution, in-kind donation violation alone would result in the kind of raid that took place yesterday, which takes us to the potential of bank fraud or wire fraud charges. If you recall, Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, he was indicted for a number of financial-related crimes, a number of things that are unrelated to Russian meddling. But that is the purview of this investigation. As we said, if they come across evidence of other things that could potentially be a crime, they could either move on that themselves, as we saw with Paul Manafort. Robert Mueller's team led those indictments, or pass them on to others to do. In this case, the Manhattan prosecutors in this case. But ultimately, what I think we really need to keep an eye on is whether these charges could give some leverage to Robert Mueller to seek to get Michael Cohen to cooperate in the investigation. We saw that happen with Michael Flynn,
right?
Agreed to investigate, to cooperate in this investigation. And in this case, there are few people in Donald Trump's orbit who are as close to him as Michael Cohen. He's been working with him for a decade. He's someone who is described as Donald Trump's fixer, someone who, so to speak, knows where the bodies are buried, and on more than one occasion wielded the shovel. So in this case, if he is brought into that investigation to get to give information, that definitely would be something that Robert Mueller's team would be interested in.
Right. And, you know, going back to what the president had said last night, he called it a threat to the country, and he seemed to be specifically discussing Robert Mueller. But it's important to note that it wasn't Mueller who brought these warrants. He actually referred them to the district in New York. However, how much should we worry that this is something that could lead the president to have an excuse to get rid of Robert Mueller?
Well, that's always the question, right? And this is something that the president has been fuming about privately, and yesterday did not rule out publicly in those comments that he made to reporters, saying that many people are saying that he should fire him. And he gave his response, which he frequently does, is we'll see what happens. Clearly not ruling it out. It's also worth noting that he defended his decision to fire James Comey in those same comments. He's clearly angry at the FBI, at the investigation in itself. And so that is something that people are continuing to wonder if that's a possibility.
Yeah, and he even used one of his favorite lines, many people are saying I should fire him, which often precludes him taking precedes him taking some action. Hey, I want to get some callers in here. We've got John Mack calling from Nashville, Tennessee. John, are you on the line?
I am, Emily. Thank you for taking the call. Just a brief comment. I certainly appreciate the remark, wielding the shovel. I'm a lawyer and with 30 years practice, private practice experience, Vanderbilt educated, formerly licensed in three states, now in Tennessee alone, former hearing officer for the Tennessee Board of Professional Responsibility.
Okay, great.
I want to make the observation that it, in fact, is the exercise of the rule of law and not at all an attack on the rule of law by the execution of these subpoenas. You know, wielding the shovels, so to speak, is exactly what the Department of Justice and the New York prosecutors are doing here. And it's a shame to me that the general public is not more familiar with the way in which these processes and procedures operate, but are subject to the disinformation and disingenuity of the president when he claims it's an attack on the rule of law.
Well, I really appreciate your call, John Mack. You know, the legal system is confusing, and we are going to try here to shed some light on how it works, and I appreciate you helping to do that. Let's take another call. Tom is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Tom. What do you want to say?
You know what? Obviously, the FBI, when they raided Cohen's office, they got something. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And now what that something is, you know, it's below the waterline right now. But as you mentioned in your earlier discussion, that warrant would not have been issued had there not been some credible evidence that what the FBI was seeking was, you know, was there in terms of what they wanted. And let me say this, and I'm going to go. Number 45, as I refer to him, because he will not be president to me, all right?
Okay.
He is, I mean, he's just been a complete disgrace to this country. We've fallen out of...
Okay. We thank you so much for your call, Tom. We're going to keep going so we can get a couple more people on the line. We've got Homer calling from Belchertown, Massachusetts. Do we have time for another call? Homer, are you there?
Hi, Emily. Yes, I am.
Hi.
How you doing? My comment is basically to do with Donald Trump and we're having shoes dropping and water dripping, and there's a lot of stuff going on. But I think the tip of the iceberg is going to be when we find out about the Russians, I think they have a lot more on him than we know about. And I believe he's being blackmailed.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to let you go. Kim, thank you so much for being here. Kimberly Atkins is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Herald. When we come back, we're going to turn to the Syrian government's most recent alleged chemical gas attack on its people and the challenge it poses for the Trump administration. You can join the conversation. What do you think the president can do, should do, about the gas attacks last weekend? I'm Emily Dreifuss. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Emily Dreifuss. The White House National Security Staff is laser focused on Syria right now, on how to respond to the weekend's chemical gas attacks, on what to do about Syria in general. You can join the conversation. What's the right response? Take out some airfields? Would that be purely symbolic? When so many powers, the U.S., Russia, Israel, Iran, and Turkey, have their own dogs in this fight, could this get much more dangerous? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. To talk about all this, I'm joined by Eli Lake in Washington. He's a columnist for Bloomberg View. You can find his most recent column on how the president should respond to the Syria situation at our website, onpointradio.org. Eli, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us from Philadelphia is Ian Lustick. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania with a focus on the Middle East. Ian, thanks to you, too.
My pleasure.
So I'm so happy to have both of you on the line. There are so many options, it seems, on the table, although maybe it boils down to three. The government in the U.S. could go all out and escalate the war in Syria, or the president could follow through on what he said he wanted to do last week, which is remove U.S. troops from Syria completely, or perhaps something like we saw last year, a more targeted attack. Let's go to you first, Ian. What do you see as the options for the U.S.?
Well, I don't think the United States has an option, realistically, to change the strategic balance of power in Syria or to change the outcome of that conflict in the near term. Also, I don't think it's an option, seriously, to leave Syria in the way the president seems to have suggested he wanted to do. The question is what kind of a limited strike we're going to be able to sustain and what would be the consequences. And I think there's a mistake to focus only on strikes against airfields or anti-aircraft battalions. I think the real point that would be different from the last time we used force would be to strike the crack units in the Assad army. These are Alawite units that are there are very few of them left after all this fighting that he's been trying to use to conquer this last remaining point of resistance in Douma. There are reports that the Tiger battalions actually suffered significant casualties trying to take Douma, and it's in response to that, I believe, that the gas was used to try to panic that situation, panic the people there out of there. So striking those kinds of battalions, really hurting them the way we mauled the Russian mercenary units back in February, inflicting devastating casualties on them, that's the way to tell Assad that we can credibly use force against him, and to deter him from using chemical weapons to in these encounters.
Now, Eli, is that what do you think about those options?
I mean, I think that that's a start, but strategically, right now, I do think that there is an important decision that before this chemical strike, the president has declined to make, and may have been kind of urging in terms of his withdrawal, which is that there is a part of the country east of the Euphrates where their U.S. helped with largely Kurdish forces to liberate areas that were under the control of ISIS.
Right.
And I think that there is an obligation there to make sure that, you know, those areas and the people living there are not going to just be conquered by the Iranian-Russian Assad axis.
Now, would that look something like a no-fly zone, or what do you
have
in
mind? Well, there is a sort of de facto no-fly zone now, but what really is needed is a kind of stronger kind of commitment that the U.S. is not going to just simply abandon that territory, and that that could, over time, at least maybe address the staggering refugee problem in Syria, where half the population of the country has been displaced.
Right.
And if you could allow people to begin moving back to their homes with some sort of understanding that there will be an international and U.S. presence there to protect them, then I think that that is the beginning. And then I think that there are a number of things that one can do to further diplomatically isolate Assad, but also his most important patrons in Russia and Iran.
Well, you brought up, you know, the human toll of this war, which is, of course, staggering. And I think that this would be a good time for us to listen to the amateur video from the gas attack over the weekend. This is from the city of Douma. You may have already heard or seen these videos. They were everywhere. They're devastating. The scene we're about to hear is dozens of crying children being hosed down in a local clinic to wash away the chemical agents that were sprayed upon them. There's an adult holding an infant face down with one arm. And as you can hear, he's slapping the child's back to try to clear their lungs of the poison. It's horrific. And I play it not to, you know, upset listeners or anyone, but just so that what you were talking about, Eli, so that we can remember that this is not an abstraction. This war has a real human element to it. And that is why I think the president seems to have changed his mind. It was only last week that he was saying he wants to, you know, draw down the troops completely. And then upon seeing and hearing things like that is when he's saying now he's contemplating some sort of further action. Ian, do you think that any action that is taken is going to be anything more than symbolic?
I think it can be more than symbolic. I was trying to suggest if you actually hurt Assad in a way that counts for him, it can be, but not in a way that affects in the short term the strategic outcome in Syria. However, there is a long game, and I agree with what Eli said, that we have to take seriously the commitments we've made on the ground to people in the east of Syria. And I think that that's been a source of struggle between the White House and the Pentagon. The military does not want to break faith with the people that it has helped and who have helped us. And I think that the outcome here is going to keep us in Syria, is going to help the Pentagon push its position that we do need to stay there. I think I would make the following point. There are always unintended consequences
right.
of things. And that means you have to be agile and quick and coherent and thoughtful in your response. Whatever we do, whether we do nothing or something, the situation is more dangerous because we have a president who is so unpredictable, who is seething, obviously, with anger, with worry, and with resentment, and is capable of shooting in different directions at the same time, has not yet demonstrated that he can guide a coherent, sustained policy in a complex situation like the one in Syria. You
right.
mentioned how complex it is. There are a dozen different actors on different sides of different questions interacting with one another here, all with the question of whether Russia has something on the president himself hanging over this whole mess. So I do believe we need to do something, but I'm worried about it, because,
right.
and I would be equally worried if we did nothing.
Well, so you mentioned how complex and moving and quick this situation is, and I want to break in with some breaking news that we just heard. President Trump's counterterror, Homeland Security, and cyber advisor Tom Bossert just resigned, the White House has announced. So there's another departure from the White House at a time when, you know, the administration seems to be not able to hold on to some of its senior advisors. This puts things even more in flux. Eli, do you think that that will affect his decision-making process?
Well, I'd have to kind of absorb all of that. I mean,
yeah.
this is something like striking Syria would fall under the National Security Advisor, which is John Bolton, who was just
right.
brought on. His first day was yesterday.
Yeah.
I want to just respond to something that Ian said there, and I largely agree with it. But on this question of what the Russians have on Trump, and, you know, I've always kind of tried to keep an open mind on it and mm-hmm. certainly oppose the efforts to try to shut down the Mueller investigation prematurely. But if at this point, given the fact that at least under Trump, Trump's government has imposed significant sanctions, most recently on Oleg Deripaska and other oligarchs, that you know the U.S. has supported Montenegro's integration into NATO, that the U.S. has shut down the Russian consulate in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
And a series of things that the Trump administration has done against Russia. Not to mention continuing the sanctions that the Russians despise for their invasion of Ukraine. I, at this point, wonder really if the Russians have this blackmail material, because why haven't they used it up to now? Because certainly, I think you can make a strong case that, you know, the Trump administration has been in some ways tougher than even Obama on Russia. And we all know that Obama began his presidency trying a reset with that relationship. So,
but there's so much movement for this administration to be even tougher on Russia, isn't there? I mean, the president
sure.
has been hesitant to even agree with his own intelligence community about Russia's role in the meddling in the U.S. election. And it was only the tweet yesterday in which he called out Putin by name, where he really was being hard on Putin's involvement with the Assad regime. So though he's being tough, there's a lot more room.
I agree that the president is baffling in his, at times, sycophancy towards Russia
yes.
and his kind of expressions of how, you know, it would be nice to get along with them, which, by the way, we should say other presidents have said, but Russia's done so much more in that time period. But that said, it's almost the opposite of what we see with most presidencies, which is that the substance is actually much tougher than the rhetoric. And usually mm-hmm. it's the other way around. And I'm just saying, in terms of the substance, if you're thinking about it from Russia's kind of a Russian perspective of what they would like to see the U.S. government do if they indeed had some sort of influence or control over the U.S. president, they've done a pretty bad job at this point, because it has not stopped sanctions, it has not stopped diplomatic censure, and it has not stopped, you know, last year the attack on its client Assad,
right.
and looks like it's not going to stop another attack, which the Russians certainly oppose at this point.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a series of things that I'm just saying the U.S. has done under Trump that are against Russian interests that at this point, I'm less of a believer that they really have serious blackmailable material on him at this point.
Well, that's really interesting. And it brings me also, sorry to interrupt you, I was going to mention what you had said earlier, which is that, you know, in February, the U.S. troops actually attacked Russian troops in Syria. And I'm not sure it got that much media attention, but many Russians were killed in an attack in Syria. So we've also proven that we're able to fight them with real weapons.
Yeah, let's move away a little from speculating what Putin has, because even if he doesn't have anything, the fake news ability, he could say he has something that would still make a lot of problems for Trump. But yet, we actually killed hundreds of Russian mercenaries, not troops. That's why Putin is able to deny that service members were involved.
Mm-hmm.
But there are tapes of the commanders of those units using extreme profanity and anger at Putin for what he was allowing to be done by the American firepower to his forces in Syria. We have to point out that the Black Sea Fleet of the Russia has been put on high alert right now, that Russia significantly escalated its relationship with Israel by declaring and detailing and releasing videotape of an Israeli attack on a Syrian base that killed Syrians and Iranians the day after the chemical mm-hmm. attack. It's in that context of the escalatory behavior where this might be the first time in decades, maybe since Berlin, where the United States and Russia are involved with active military forces, significant, in the same theater at the same time with contrary objectives and with no sense that their intelligence and military capacities are interlocked with a hotline that works. That's what's worrying me.
I want to follow up on what you were just saying and talk about the broader risks of a confrontation between the players who are at work here in the Syrian war. You know, we don't have rules for a new Cold War yet, but things are really heating up. And these countries don't really seem like they understand when or how they will cross each other's red lines.
You know, you use a really important word there, the rules. The Cuban Missile Crisis was the most important crisis in the post-Cold War period. But the reason it was important is it helped the United States and the Soviet Union figure out how they could compete safely with one another so that we knew what kinds of actions by which side, a blockade or a declaration of this sort or another, would mean a serious escalation and what wouldn't. In the post-unipolar world, that is, after the fall of the Soviet Union, when the United States for a decade or so was so dominant, we didn't have those kinds of confrontations.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're having confrontations in a messy multipolar world without the rules that that each side knows about how to engage in that kind of competition. And with the lack of coherent leadership in Washington able to set new rules and learn them and abide by them, that's what makes this complicated situation so dangerous and such a defining moment for the post-Cold War period and for the Trump administration.
Right. Okay, well, I really appreciate you guys. I want to take some calls now. We're going to get Diane is on the phone from Natick. Diane?
Hi, Emily. I have a few comments. First off, that this Syrian chemical attack has been reported as alleged or suspected.
Right, because no one's been able to get in yet to verify.
And that's correct. So we should not assume that they have done it, because back in 2013, when the United Nations mission collected evidence and showed that the rebels had these chemical weapons, chemical compounds. So I think that we can't jump to conclusions. I also say that, what motive does Assad have at this point?
Well, I think we discussed what one of them was, but I'll give this over to Eli or Ian. Who wants to take this?
Well, the motive question is an interesting one, and I try to give a suggestion of the answer. Usually, gas is used by states when they're desperate and have no other option, or when they just want to remotely use terror against civilians and achieve their objectives with keeping their own casualties low.
Right.
And that's what Assad is doing in Douma. And I think that's the best reason we can think of for why he would risk. Also, it's possible that he thought he was going to not kill more than a couple dozen civilians and that it would be under the radar. But the gas went into the shelters and killed many more and raised it probably beyond what he felt.
And it's not as though, it's important to note, it's not as though this is the first chemical weapons attack in Syria since the Trump administration hit Syria back last year. There have actually been five gas attacks since then.
Also, let me say this, that when you have a dispute, the force that does not allow journalists into the area is the burden of proof is on them. They're the ones likely to be lying. And in this case, that's the Assad regime.
Right. Okay.
And I would just add one more thing here, which is that that there has been proof and evidence that Syrians have done these chemical weapons attacks before.
Yes.
And in every turn, the Russians pretend that nothing happened. The Russians are, in this particular case, particularly when it comes to Syria, pathological liars. So I wouldn't believe anything they say.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Eli. Now, we're talking about what the White House should do and what it can do about the Syrian regime's continuing use of chemical weapons and whether the superpowers and regional powers involved in this war could find themselves in a bigger conflict. When we come back, we're going to hear another voice, one that says it's over, it's too late, and that the U.S. just needs to face up to that. You can join the conversation. Do you agree? Should we strike the regime as a moral message, but then get out? Should we be focusing on helping refugees? I'm Emily Dreyfus. This is On Point.
It's Lulu Miller, and I am back with a new story for Invisibilia. It is about the pleasures.
It's just electric.
And the dangers.
There's just nothing more scary.
Of trying to live between two worlds. You can find Invisibilia on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Emily Dreyfus. We're looking at the White House's vow to make Syria's Bashar al-Assad pay for the weekend chemical attacks on his own people. It's a heck of a dilemma, and the situation now could get a lot worse before it gets better. You can join the conversation. Should the president follow through on his promise to get U.S. troops out? Should we be focusing on humanitarian aid, helping those millions of displaced Syrians, rather than on more war? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Ian Lustick, professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania, and Eli Lake, columnist for Bloomberg View. On Monday, Senator Lindsey Graham was on Fox and Friends. Graham said the president must follow on his tweet promising a broad and tough response to the chemical attack, or he'll look weak in the eyes of Russia and Iran.
That Assad and his inner circle should be considered war criminals, legitimate military targets. If you have the opportunity to take him out, you should. You should ground his air force. You should destroy his air force. We should set up safe zones inside of Syria, telling the Russians and the Iranians and anything left of Assad, if you cross this line, we'll shoot you down.
Now, that sounds a lot like what we've been discussing in the earlier segment. I want to bring on a third voice now. Joshua Landis is professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and a Syria expert. He joins us today from Arezzo, Italy. Josh, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you.
Thank you so much for being here. Josh, what do you make of this mess?
Well, keeping a line on the the international agreed not using chemical weapons is important. It was established by Obama. It was upheld by Trump in his first strike against Syria. And I think it's an international norm that needs to be upheld.
So how do we do that?
I agree with Ian that you can make Assad, change his calculations towards this. And I think his analysis is correct. The question then is, the larger question for U.S. policy is, should the U.S. retain its control over 30% of Syrian territory in the north of Syria and try to turn the Kurdish presence there into a viable, independent or autonomous nation with a military force and to rebuild northern Syria. That, I think, is a fool's errand. I think the United States has largely lost in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Iran, Russia have got a predominant position there, particularly Iran. And we are not going to be able to roll back Iran. Our strategy today is by withholding Syria's oil, of which 50%, more than 50%, is in the north, which we control, and water and agricultural land, that we can impoverish Syria and Assad and make the Iranians and Russians pay through this impoverishment. And that, you know, that's a good strategy for hurting Russia and Iran. The problem is it also hurts the Syrian people, unless you're going to overthrow Assad and occupy the country and provide it with better governments. But we're not. We have no plans to do that.
Right. There's no appetite for that.
There is no appetite for that. And so in that case, rather than sitting there and pursuing a sort of dog in the manger policy of not letting them win, I think it's better to allow Iran and Russia to try to rebuild Syria in some viable way so that people can get jobs back. Today, America's blocking all the highways in and out of Syria. It's a highway to Baghdad, highway to Amman, and so forth. And this is going to, you know, this is going to bring collapse not only to Syria, but possibly Lebanon as well economically. And I think it will only make terrorism worse, the humanitarian crisis worse. Refugees will not return. I don't think it really helps America. America should be spending its money at home.
Yeah, so Josh, I mean, what you're saying is really in line with what the president had been trying to call for last week, which was just to get out. But I think it strikes me that the main impediment to him doing so is that in order to do what you're saying, it would mean the America admitting we lost and trying to work with the Assad regime. Now,
America can take an arm's length distance from the Assad regime. The problem is the Kurds. We owe the Kurds a debt. They helped us destroy ISIS. But America can get a better deal for the Kurds than they've ever had by helping them to get more of the oil in the north, more agriculture, more of the money. And the Kurds have worked with Assad throughout this war. They've been frenemies, if you will. Huh. But they've had relations. They've traded oil. They've traded agriculture and movement. So in that sense, the Kurds need to live in Syria. If America tries to build up an independent Kurdistan and rebuild all of northern Syria, they don't have an independent oil grid. They don't have an independent electricity grid, schools, you name it. America will have to build all of those. They don't have any money. Turkey and Syria will squeeze them. So how are they going to trade? They need good relations with Syria. Syria needs good relations with the Kurds. There is a deal to be made there. And Turkey would probably accept it if Assad were in, you know, nominally in control and could keep the Kurds from building an independent army, which is what they fear. So I think that America can achieve its debt and repay its debt to the Kurds without creating an independent nation, which will not roll back Iran, which is the real objective of most of the people proposing this this policy, which I think we can't build a viable nation there, and we shouldn't try. It will be a giant money sink, and we'll fail.
Well, I'd love to get your perspective on that, Eli. That sounds like something you've called for. Is that in line with what you're hoping will happen?
Well, I just think that what Dr. Landis has just said is a recipe for disaster for the region. First of all, if the U.S. decides to do that, there are other players. The Israelis, the Saudis, the Gulf states would likely not allow the Iranians to have their sort of continuous land bridge to the Mediterranean. And at that point, we would have even less control. Second of all, I don't think that it's possible at this point for any Syrian, for most Syrian people to accept the legitimacy of Bashar al-Assad. And the notion that somehow he could survive and unify the country and Syrians would feel safe, I think is really extreme wishful thinking. The truth of the matter is that Assad, even if he wins in the short term, will lose. He will always have a target on his back. I think he will always be dogged by, you know, calls for him to be hauled before various European courts in the future. And more importantly, I think that there are just as a generation and really two generations at this point of Syrians who would like nothing more than to see him and his family dead. And I don't think that that's going to be solved by a swift exit or allowing the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrians to win. Even though I agree that there are obviously increasing humanitarian problems. But at this point, why should anybody expect that Assad will change his behavior if effectively he gets away with all of this? So, again, I don't think that that necessarily means another Iraq invasion, you know, a nation building again like we saw in 2003.
Right.
But at the same time, there are things you can do to try to at least protect the Kurdish regions. And I wouldn't say that you want to build an independent Kurdistan in northern and eastern Syria at this point. That's probably not a great idea, because a lot of Arabs would not be comfortable with that. But at least you want to try to create some space where they would not have to submit to the Iranians, the Russians, and their Assad, who've just behaved, who've broken every possible rule of conflict that we can think of, beyond just simply the chemical weapons. And at this point, I mean, I think that if we want to try to preserve any kind of deterrence or shred of international law when it comes to not just chemical weapons, but all kinds of other war crimes, we just can't accept that. And also, we would be basically, I think, turning it over to a really out of control, potentially huge destabilizing regional war, because I don't think the Israelis or the Saudis or our other Gulf allies would accept that.
And
Ian, you got something?
Yes. Well, there's one – it's interesting that there's one kind of activity that has not been mentioned at all, and that's diplomacy. Maybe that's not a surprise, given that we don't have a Secretary of State, and even if we did, it's not clear if it would matter. But one of the ways in which this can go forward that would be positive would be if we do, as I think we all agree, including Joshua, that we should uphold the norm against gas attacks by doing something that really hurts Assad.
Right.
That gives us something in the Syrian long game. That's what we've got to watch for. And once we establish our credibility on that issue, if we can reach out to the Iranians and their by saying we're not getting out of the nuclear deal, we're going to work with you, not against you, and deal with the Israeli Arab Palestinian Israeli situation too, which by the way would be on the front burner because of Israeli killings of Gazans trying to escape from Gaza if it weren't for this gas problem, gas attack in Syria. But we should be firing on all cylinders diplomatically when in the aftermath of our strike against Assad, which I am quite confident is going to happen. If that occurs, we don't have to choose between conquering or ejecting Assad now or withdrawing. We can be involved in a long game in which Assad is constrained not to massacre his own people, having achieved what he's dreamed of, which is complete power for his Alawite minority.
Sure, but
that's what we need to prevent.
How worried are you that actually a strike on Syria and maybe further sanctions against Russia and Iran could actually be prelude to the Trump administration saying, look, this is why we're going to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. We can't trust you guys.
Well, of course, I can't predict what the president will do as a result. And of course, with John Bolton at his side, that makes it even less likely that the diplomatic strategy I'm suggesting would be followed.
Right.
On the other hand, if we go ahead and we have British and French support, that enmeshes us with allies who are completely opposed to the idea that we should walk away from the Iran deal. It makes it more likely that we're going to need those allies. We're going to need that Iran deal. And remember, Russia is one of the signatories to that. So it's not impossible to work with Russia on issues that we have a joint interest in. So remember, I want to go into Saudi Arabia, Turkey. These are all elements at play here.
Yeah, there's so many players involved.
Yes, we haven't time even to go into them all.
We're going to take some calls now. Austin is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Austin, what do you got?
Hi, Emily.
Hi.
I just want to say I think we really need to get out of there, and the Middle East in general. We've already been over there way too long as it is. And we know this is like an ongoing game. So it's really good for the world bankers that make a lot of profit off this. So you can see how there would be some incentive there for them to escalate this into some World War III scenario. Yeah. I think they're expecting Trump to counterattack, because anytime something like this happens, it demands a counterattack. Otherwise, you know, you reveal your fundamental weakness. But, you know, we're the United States. We don't – so – of course, you would intervene in something like that.
Well, yeah, it's really complicated, and the desire to get our troops home and to get ourselves out of that is I think felt, people feel that across the board, but then there's also, you know, the right thing to do, and as Josh was talking about, we really owe a debt to the Kurdish fighters who have helped us in the battle against ISIS, and leaving them in the lurch would be a really hard decision. Now, listen, let's go to another call. Dan is calling from Pensacola, Florida. Dan.
Yes, I am, Lee. The
Hi.
Man was talking about credibility before, and credibility is everything. We got refugees by the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, that are dying on a grander scale, mostly children and elderly people.
Yeah.
And so you're lacking credibility there when it comes to chemical weapons. The contractors in Fallujah, I remember that, they used white phosphorus on them, two of Parliament members resigned because the government of Britain was forced to admit that they had to use white phosphorus on the people in Fallujah. I mean, Americans might like it here, but over there, they know that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, America doesn't have much credibility. You can't do stuff like that. And then,
thank you so much for the call, Dan. You bring up a really important question, and it's something I want to have a chance for us to talk about in the end of this hour here, which is, you know, we've been talking about military response, but what duty do we as America have to the millions of displaced Syrians that this war has caused? And how can we've been talking about military options, but how can we actually use humanitarian aid to focus on helping them? Just last week, and Eli, I'd love to hear your perspective on this. Just last week, the U.S. government froze $200 million that was earmarked for Syrian humanitarian aid. Is there a way in which we could pivot to focusing on helping the people?
I think the two things go hand in hand. First of all, it's a humanitarian projects to try to rebuild areas where there is a U.S. presence has a military strategic aim, and that is to create a kind of alternative government to, at the time, ISIS, or so that ISIS is not resurgent, or, you know, and to create longer-term allies. And second of all, you can't really do humanitarian reconstruction without at least some sort of military force on the ground. It's all really part of the same project. I think that there's a lot the U.S. has learned since the Iraq War. And the model that has emerged is that the U.S., through its special operations, can work with local forces fairly efficiently, as we saw against ISIS. And that is a very different kind of thing than a coalition provisional authority that, you know, decides to have a constitution, you know, writing committee and all of the other things that are attendant with the sort of grand nation building and somewhat delusional grandeur of 2003. Mm-hmm. There are incremental, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. And I would just point out to the earlier caller that, yes, I agree. I cover the Middle Eastern wars now for almost 20 years, and it is very frustrating. And the U.S. is by no means perfect and has made many grave errors at times. But the alternative is what we've seen unfolding in Syria, and that is just a ghastly humanitarian crisis that is not going to stop without at least some kind of intervention, hopefully something of the more international variety, but it really is a call to all civilized nations.
Now, Josh, I want to let you have the last word here, and I'd love it to be about refugees because, you know, as Eli was just talking about what we could do from a humanitarian perspective within Syria, but there are millions of people displaced. What can we do to help them?
Well, the United States has spent about $30 billion on Syria, according to some estimates, and it has only, by funding the opposition and building up militias and trying to take on the Assad government, we have drawn out this war.
Yeah.
Our efforts have led to greater refugee flows and more destruction in Syria in the same way they have in Iraq. And to think that somehow by spending more money and building up a new militia in northern Syria, we are going to create peace in Syria, I think is we're deluding ourselves.
Now, Josh, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're coming to the end here. I'm sorry. I want to thank Eli Lake, Ian Lustig, Josh Landis. Thank you so much for all of you being here. I'm Emily Dreyfus. This is On Point.